We hope you enjoy this recording of a live broadcast brought to you by Torah in Motion. For more learning opportunities, please visit www.torahinmotion.org.
Again, thank you, Rabbi Kelman and Dr. Melamed, for organizing this. It's I'm impressed, and it has to be said, and kol hakavod to you guys. This is very much now the historical kind of talk, and it's really an effort at contextualizing orthodoxy. So it's a chance to think back. In general, when we talk about the history of orthodoxy, it's effectively, we think about orthodoxy as a response to reform. And we use sort of two dates here. We talk about 1819. In 1819, a group of Jews in Hamburg set up their own independent synagogue. And the Hamburg Beit Din, and this is a synagogue, they used their own Sidur, and they did things a little differently. And they did it without asking the Rabbanim. Why should they? I mean, again, what you have to appreciate is by 1819, there were many Jews who had effectively drifted away or walked away from traditional observance. And for them, what went on in a traditional shul didn't speak to them, didn't mean anything. And as a matter of fact, their argument was that, look, if we offer a different kind of shul experience, we'll be able to attract people back. This was very much, I think, and sincerely so, the intention on the part of this group in Hamburg. Well, the Beit Din in Hamburg didn't take to this very kindly. And what they did is immediately issue a proclamation saying, Asur. Absolutely. Is it permissible to pray in German? No. Is it permissible to change, the nusach of the tefillah? No. Everything was no, no, no. And fine, they came out, they were opposed. And what they did, though, was ask the other Rabbanim in Europe to support them, which, of course, the other Rabbanim did. This book is called Eile Divrei Habrit, and it was published in 1819. That's very often, this is how we begin sort of the history of orthodoxy. Then, of course, and the Chatam Sofer and other sort of major Rabbanim participated in that. In terms of a different kind of orthodoxy, we generally think of the 1830s, again, with Hirsch publishing the 19 letters. I mentioned that in my previous talk. And with Hirsch comes a different kind of orthodoxy, an orthodoxy that is not just about saying no, but about offering some kind of a positive yes, something. And this is what I really want to get to, but I want to sort of go about this talk in the following way. So the question is, what is the proper context to understand the beginnings of orthodoxy? Is it simply that orthodoxy emerged as a reaction to reform? And that's honestly the primary way in which it is taught and discussed. Adam Ferziger, who's here, except he's in the other talk, has tried to say, look, there are other ways of thinking about the beginnings of orthodoxy. And as a matter of fact, there are already in Europe, even before reform arises, non-observant Jews. And basically, Adam's argument, and it's an intelligent and an important one, is that the Rabbanim, even in the beginning of the, in the 17th, early 18th century, are already dealing with the phenomena of Jews who are simply not as observant as, the tradition would seem to require, and that grappling with this phenomena of non-observance already begins to create, if you will, a kind of an orthodoxy. So that's a different way. It's not so much the institutional rise of reform as much more almost of a social reality of what do you do when not everybody is observant. So that's a different way of cutting it. I want to go about this even in a third way or a different way, and that is to place orthodoxy in the context of the rise of the Jewish Enlightenment, the Haskalah. Now again, truth in advertising, this is my field. This is my day job. This is what I spend my life writing about and studying. I think it does bring a different perspective. So this is very much a talk about the Jewish Enlightenment. Now, what is the Jewish Enlightenment? Again, I have to be fair here, and in a few moments, sort of lay this out for you. The Jewish Enlightenment is a phenomena very much of Germany, actually primarily based in Berlin, that arose at the end of the 18th century. The major figure we tend to think about is Moses Mendelssohn, and the years are basically the 1770s. And the 1780s. But it's not Mendelssohn alone. There's another fellow by the name of Naftali Hertz Weisel, Wesley, as we call him, a third fellow by the name of Shlomo Dubno, and and I'll explain in a moment what I mean, other more radical members of the Haskalah, of the Jewish Enlightenment, one by the name of David Friedlander, and Solomon Maimon. Point is that at the end of the 18th century, in the 1770s and 1780s, there are already a number of Jews who are grappling with, struggling with, how to handle various changes going on in European society. Okay? And they have to do this, why? Because at this point, there are all kinds of pressures to somehow bring the Jewish community more into German society. In other words, the impetus is actually coming not from the Jews. The impetus is coming from the Habsburgs, the Austrian leaders, and from the Prussian emperors as well. In other words, their society is changing, and for various reasons, they are looking for ways of how to sort of break down this barrier, if you will, between the non-Jews and the Jews. Again, it's an impetus from the outside. The Jews are forced to react. I know I'm simplifying this, of course, but again, in the purposes here, I think we have to. The Jews are forced into a kind of reactive mode. As with anything, the reactions then tend to be on a spectrum, which is to say, on the one hand, you have fairly radical individuals like David Friedlander, Solomon Maimon, and others who effectively break with tradition, who effectively get very swept up with the spirit of the Enlightenment, and who are saying, you know, this is now our ticket, if you will. The truth is, both of them flirted with conversion. They both became very, very German in their thinking. They clearly walked away from traditional practices and ideas. And both of them were trying to then find their places as Jews, basically in a German society. But the trick then was that there was really no room. Dr. Heuberger spoke about this in a previous session as well. At this point, you still were either a Jew or a Christian. And here you now had a few Jews who were trying to be a different kind of Jew and not yet Christian. This didn't exist. In a certain sense, these individuals were really kind of stuck nowhere. In the case of Solomon Maimon, by the way, his autobiography is available in English as well. And it's interesting to read. He really is, in some ways, a lost soul. This is what happens. This is what happens when, you know, societies change and cultures change, and suddenly some people are stuck not belonging here nor there. But for the purposes of this talk, I want to focus on the first few I mentioned, Moses Mendelssohn, Naftali Hertz-Weisel, Shlomo Dubno, etc., a group of individuals who were actually seeking, struggling to find ways of both balancing, maybe you can even use integrating, acculturation on one side. In other words, yes, the Jews would become more and more part of German society, but at the same time, balancing that with tradition. And that's a much harder thing to do. But this is what they were, what they set out to do. In 1782, there's an interesting book published called Divrei Shalom Ve'emet. It's a book by Naftali Hertz-Weisel, and it's interesting for us to think about, because we always think, well, let's start backwards. You know, many of us are products of or send our children to schools with a dual education, right? Netivot, Hebrew Academy, or Chaim Ulpana, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, of course, it's not just these schools. But where does this idea come from, of a dual education, of somehow having Limudei Kodesh, Limudei Chol? The truth is, the very first idea of it, I hope I didn't skip. If I missed the school now, I realize I'm in big trouble. I'll just stick with Hebrew Academy. Montreal is much safer to... Divrei Shalom Vemet, 1782, this idea is already floated. Naftali Hertz-Weisel floats it. He says, look, he welcomes the changes, in this case reacting to a specific new law passed by the Habsburg Emperor, that actually starts demanding that Jews give their children secular education. Again, the impetus is because someone else is demanding it. Now, the Rabbanim in the Habsburg Empire, how do you think they would react? Well, no. He said, that's right, you might think they're not interested. They didn't have a choice. When the emperor decrees, I don't care who you are, and these Rabbanim are not stupid, they say, okay. And they kind of went along with it. Weisel, Naftali Hertz-Weisel, in his Divrei Shalom Ve'emet, is the one Jew who kind of jumped up and down and said, this is an opportunity. This is great. This is not just bediavad, it's milechatchila. Right? This is, again, very, very important. This debate begins there. Now, he got himself into a fair bit of trouble with some of the other Rabbanim. And interestingly, if I can just, again, do this al regel achat, he got himself into trouble because, as opposed to the Rabbanim who said, okay, we'll go along with it, he was way too enthusiastic. And in being enthusiastic, some of the ways in which he tried to articulate what is the relationship between Limudei Kodesh and Limudei Chol, you know, the, religious studies and our secular studies, they felt that he went too far and too overboard. But again, be aware that the idea of having secular and Jewish studies as part of one educational framework was not Hirsch's brainstorm. Okay? We always think, again, there's no question Hirsch deserves a lot of credit for a lot of things, but this precedes him by many years. Hirsch was only born in 1808. This is 1782. You do the math. So that's point number one. But what I want to say even more generally, and this is not so well known, I admit this is what I do for a living, so these are things that I do try to spend time thinking about, is going back not only to Weisel, but even someone like Moses Mendelssohn, who admittedly becomes something of a lightning rod. And Mendelssohn, really unfairly, is often blamed for everything that's wrong with the modern era, and he's the father of reform, and he's the father of this and the father of that. He's the father of six children. He's not the father of reform. Some of whom converted, which is absolutely an important point to touch on, except that you have to realize this because his kids converted decades after he died. And his children were relatively young when he died, and there's not any question that he would not have approved. I mean, this luckily he was dead, I would say, not to have seen his children convert. In any event, he and the others, I think, again, struggled with how to sort of, what to do with this new reality of the Jews becoming more and more part of European and German society. And in part, I have to say, their struggle was a sense of realizing that Jews are going to absorb more and more European ideas, but the European ideas, and I'll mention in a moment just what I mean here, it's not like Europe is a neutral place. It's not like Europe is neutral towards Jews and Judaism. Okay? Europe is a place that's very hostile to Jews and Judaism. The European Enlightenment was not exactly Jewish-friendly, if I could put it that way. This is, again, speaking very simply and crassly, but capturing accurately some of the reality here. So the question is that they're trying to figure out is how do we both encourage Jews and even now encourage an educational system that looks towards integration and how to handle that the integration is towards a society that's very hostile to us. And what do you mean by hostile to us? So let me stop and point this out. I think the two sort of fundamental points to pick up on is that if you look at the European Enlightenment and its conception of Jews and Judaism, something becomes immediately apparent. Now, obviously, Christianity shares one important text with us. It's called what they call the Old Testament, what we call the Tanakh. Fair enough. What's wrong with Judaism in the eyes of European culture is not the Tanakh, it's Chazal. It's what the Jews built on top of the biblical tradition. Obviously, they deny that any sense that there's a true oral tradition. They always and quite quickly and immediately go right at what we would call rabbinic Judaism. They go at the Mishnah and the Talmud and the Midrashim, etc., and critique that as saying, you see, that's where Judaism went wrong. Now, obviously, what is a Christian believing? That with Jesus, with his birth and death, etc., they have they build off of the Old Testament, of the of Scripture, and build in a very different direction. The point is that there's this unrelenting criticism and critique, number one, of rabbinic Judaism. And again, all of us, I think, in this room appreciate that Judaism is rabbinic Judaism. We're not Karaim, and even we don't live only according to Mikra. We live according to, the teachings of Chazal. That's obviously what defines us and what defines our tradition. But in European eyes, this is exactly what was wrong with Judaism. This is what Mendelssohn and the others realized, and they realized immediately, precisely because they were well-read. And they knew what they were getting into. They knew that this is a society very hostile. Even better than that, I think, or more importantly here, when they began at this very time to have debates about Jewish emancipation, which is to say giving the Jews equal rights, one of the things that came out over and over again, and again, it's a Christian debate, right? It's the Christians themselves debating, should we or shouldn't we? Should we give the Jews more rights? Shouldn't we give the Jews more rights? And the Jews are, imagine yourself to be a third party listening to two people talking about you, whether to admit you into their club. And that affects you, right? You're sitting there going, hold on a second. But Jews didn't exactly have a voice here. I mean, Mendelssohn tried to insert his voice into it, but by and large, the debate is taking place, again, among primarily German scholars, intellectuals, policymakers, etc. And one of the issues that again comes up is, well, can the Jews even fit into our society? Now, some said yes, some said no. But first of all, the ones that said no, frankly, had, you know, said, well, what do you mean? How are Jews going to fit into our society? You know, they don't work on Saturday. We do work on Saturday. Our day off is Sunday. Their day off, you know, so to speak, is Saturday. How? What? Let's think about the obvious, right? Jews are going to join German society. They're going to have to then be willing to be drafted into the army. Army was very, very important in Prussia. Now, how exactly are we going to take Jews into our army? We don't offer kosher food. And we're not. What are we going to do Friday afternoon? Say, okay, you're off for the day? That's not how the Prussian army works. It's not how any European army works, and they knew this. So when they were debating whether Jews can be integrated into their society, they made it very clear that that one very large and clear impediment were the Jews themselves. So then the debate really became, well, should we admit them into our society and hope they'll kind of change a little and fit in? Because, you know, you can't expect 99% to accommodate the 1%. You expect the 1%, the Jews, to accommodate themselves to the 99%. And others said, what are you talking about? There's no way we can integrate the Jews into our society. They're not going to fit in. They don't belong here. When they stand up and pray, they don't pray to Berlin. They pray to Jerusalem. What are they waiting for? They're waiting for ultimately some Mashiach to come and save them and take them and remove them from the fatherland, meaning Germany, to Israel. They're not going to be patriotic citizens, etc., etc. So there's a sense in which, as this is all happening, that the Jews are being spoken about, and what's being pointed to over and over again is that they're, you know, that the whole edifice, if you will, of Chazal, of rabbinic literature and their practices just make it impossible. This is the issue that the Jewish Enlightenment, certainly the more traditional members of the Jewish Enlightenment, like Mendelssohn and Weisel, this is what they have to deal with. Why am I saying this? It's because they had to deal with it and respond. And they did, in their own way, try to respond. They tried to argue, for example, in Mendelssohn's Perush on the Torah and in other writings, he tried to argue, now, you'll see there's a real irony here. He tried to argue that, of course, the Torah Sheba Al Peh and the Torah Sheba Ktav are linked. That one is a natural outgrowth of the other. It's not true to say that somehow rabbinic Judaism is some distortion of the Torah. What's interesting here is that who's making the claim that, you know, that Chazal distort the Torah? It's the non-Jews. But who hears that is only a few intellectuals like Mendelssohn. And yet he's writing to his own community about and trying to develop all these ideas about how Chazal are truly a natural, organic outgrowth of Mikra, of the Bible. In some ways, there's a funny conversation taking place here. He's trying to explain something and even defend Judaism against something that most people aren't even aware of. Okay, and this is a subtlety here that I just laid out for you. But in any event, he and the others are trying to argue that there is an oral tradition, that the oral tradition is a bona fide tradition, and that therefore Judaism is not some distortion. So they're beginning now, in other words, they're hearing the Europeans, and they're trying to respond in kind. Okay? Now, what is my point here? Again, we think of Hirsch, and we think writing in the 1830s and 1840s, and we tend to think that that's where the response to all the challenges and threats of the modern era come from. I've just showed you that it's not true. It really genuinely begins, you know, really a generation, almost two generations before Hirsch. So this is now my next sort of puzzle here. There is, in other words, a heritage, if you will, or a tradition passed down by the Jewish Enlightenment figures. Was Hirsch aware of this? Absolutely. How do I know he was aware of this? I'll give you a couple of very simple sort of facts and ideas here. Number one, his grandfather, Hirsch's father's father, was somebody who had corresponded with Moses Mendelssohn. They clearly knew who Mendelssohn was. They certainly knew that in the family. The better example here is his uncle. His uncle's name was Moses Frankfurter. Moses ben Menachem Mendel Frankfurter. That's the name he went by. This fellow Moses Frankfurter was a very big fan of the early Maskilim. He's a very big fan of the Haskalah. How do I know this? Because he eventually changed his name. Remember, his father was Menachem Mendel. He changed his name to Moses Mendelssohn. This is Samuel Hirsch's uncle, who became known as Moses Mendelssohn of Hamburg, as opposed to the other fellow who was Moses Mendelssohn of Berlin. You don't change your name just like that, I think, unless you are really a true fan of, you know, of something here. More than that, we actually, in his writings, for example, he talks about when he was a young fellow of about 20, how he went to meet the old, at this point he was, you know, really quite old, Naftali Hertz Weisel, the man who wrote that book about integrating, you know, Jewish and general studies. And he talks about his meeting with him, and it's interesting. And at the end of this section, he says, and you know, he left behind, he wrote a lot, which he did, and he left behind all kinds of manuscripts, you know, all kinds of essays and things that he wrote that he never got to publish. And if you're interested, my nephew, Samson Rafal, has them. That's, of course, Hirsch, which is, by the way, a wonderful tip-off to where the manuscripts of Weisel, of one of the early main maskilim, ended up. It ended up in Hirsch's possession. Obviously, he's connected to this literature and cares very much. It should also be pointed out, in the 1850s, for example, there was an essay published in Frankfurt, clearly written by a reformer, writing a very sort of pro-reform, anti-orthodox treatise. And among other things, this guy claimed that, of course, we all know that Mendelssohn would have supported reform and not orthodoxy. To which Hirsch responded, in writing, saying, absolutely not true. And what you see is something of a tug of war of the legacy of Mendelssohn. Again, Hirsch very well appreciating what they had to offer and coming to Mendelssohn's defense and quoting Mendelssohn at length, saying, absolutely not. He was in no shape or form somebody who would have supported reform. So you see that Hirsch unquestionably had an appreciation for this earlier generation and their struggles. But here's where there's a nice little twist to what I want to do today. I'm not just content to say, okay, fine, so you know, there is an earlier generation or two who struggled with certain basic ideas, and Hirsch came out of that tradition, and now we can go home. It would be nice, right? But there's still at least one more hurdle to jump. Let's move back. Again, Hirsch is writing in the 1830s. The question really, if I may ask it this way, is, you know, as these changes were developing, and frankly, you had more and more Jews really drifting away from traditional practice. I say drifting away because, again, at this point, reform wasn't really fully in existence yet. I mean, there was that one temple in Hamburg. But that was only Hamburg. I mean, there's the rest of Germany. Germany's a huge place. And all kinds of towns and cities, etc. And you clearly begin seeing more and more individuals or families that effectively just stop showing up. Quite literally, they just stop showing up to shul. They might be members because they have to legally be members, but it's obvious that traditional Judaism doesn't draw them. And, you know, they have whatever. I mean, how to understand this phenomenon is not so simple. But the Rabbanim were certainly aware of this in the year 1800 and 1805 and 1810 and 1815 and 20 and 25. Question is, how did they respond? In other words, were they simply mute? Were they clueless? And suddenly you have to wait till a Hirsch to stand up and say, you know, the house is on fire, let's deal with this? Not at all. And I think you can imagine that reasonable, intelligent Rabbanim look around and are aware. And the truth is, they were aware. And effectively, what I have found, and what is interesting, is that as they begin becoming more and more aware, and as they begin to realize, you know, we really have to do something to protect our traditions, they start responding, even pre-Hirsch. Now the question is, okay, so let's look at how they responded. Did they respond like Hirsch did? Did they respond differently? Let me use a few examples here, historical examples. In the 1820s, there was a fellow by the name of Rav Naftali Banet. His father happened to be a very important Rav, Rav Mordechai Banet, who was the chief rabbi of Moravia. Now, what became very popular in these new Jewish day schools. Remember we talked about the fact that the law mandated that Jews have secular education. What Jewish communities did then is open up new schools, parallel to the cheder, if you will, where you'd have Limudei Kodesh and Limudei Chol. What textbooks did these schools use? Right? Very practical question. And the truth is they started writing their own textbooks. What was very popular then, I know this is sort of mind-blowing today, it's the last thing on earth we would think of, Well, they started doing is developing what basically are catechisms. Right? I don't know if you know Christian catechisms. It's a way of teaching by using question and answer. What do we believe? We believe in the Torah. What is the Torah? This is the Torah. And this is what kids would be taught. And this is how the teacher would use these catechisms. Of course, you go on, more and more detailed questions. Rav Naftali Banet, clearly coming out of a very traditional, very learned family, actually published two of these kinds of catechisms, basically basic Jewish textbooks. But in this case, he was adamant to make sure that these books conform to traditional Judaism. Because there were lots of these books around, and lo and behold, you would guess, they weren't exactly all traditional. Some of them gave sort of very vague answers or just answers that would not be acceptable to traditional Jews. Anyhow, in one of these books, in 1827, he writes a book, interestingly enough, not only intended to children now, but even adults, because you realize the problem is not only the kids, it's their parents. And he goes through these series of questions. Lo and behold, one of the questions is, titled Tradition. And in this section, he basically asks, what is the oral law? What is Torah Sheval Peh? Seems to be what would be a fundamental question. And then he launches into a 5-page answer. In this answer, he says he's quoting Rav Yosef Albach, the Sefer Ikarim. Some of you may know it's a medieval text. And his other source is Mendelssohn. He's using Mendelssohn to defend Torah Sheval Peh. Why? Well, Mendelssohn wrote in German. He's writing in German. And Mendelssohn wrote in a very interesting and elegant and sophisticated way. And bingo, you now see an example of when somebody has to stand up and explain tradition and explain what is Torah Sheval Peh. What tools does he have at his disposal? Well, he has the writings of the Maskilim who lived only 20, 30 years before, and in fact were already addressing the questions. And the truth is, I can give you examples, I can multiply them. In Posen, exactly the same years, middle of the 1820s, there's a fellow by the name of Rabbi Solomon Plessner, who was in contact with and worked with Rabbi Akiva Eger, again considered one of the great Rabbanim of the 19th century. Somebody had apparently attacked or issued an attack on the Talmud, and it was felt, Jews, we need to respond. We need to defend the Talmud. So Rabbi Akiva Eger apparently asked this Rav Shlomo Plessner, who could write in German and was a very articulate and bright man, to produce a treatise that would defend the Talmud. What does he do? He writes a German version and a Hebrew version. Just to cut to the chase here, he argues that the Talmud in fact shows great scholarly insight into the Bible. That's a very important claim. We may not appreciate that today, but in a world where they were claiming that Chazal did not know how to read the Bible, right, where the Talmud and the Mishnah show only a distortion of what Tanakh has to say, never really reading accurately, because that's what Europeans believe. They needed to find a way of saying that's not true. Who does he quote again? You got it. Mendelssohn, Weisel, etc. In other words, what you're seeing in the 1820s, when they're beginning to respond and figure out a way of responding, is over and over again they fall back on the writings of the early Maskilim. In a certain sense, when I ask myself the question, why, and I do ask that, I think the answer is because that was the tools available. They didn't have any other means of trying to explain what is the Torah, what it is that traditional Jews believe. There was a limited set of tools at their disposal. And that's what they kept coming back to over and over again. So the truth is that although the Haskalah very often gets a bad rap, and very often gets the bad rap of saying, well, they broke with tradition, A, it's not true, and B, when you can see in the early 19th century, when they're coming to defend tradition, they keep using their writings. When I say this, and now I think we can create a better context and an understanding of what Hirsch did. Hirsch was fully aware of everything I think I've had to say here. And yet, what is so remarkable about Hirsch, and I say this in his praise, and a way now of appreciating, I think, historically, he was fully aware and yet broke with this. What's different and important about Hirsch is he realized that just rehashing these arguments are not going to work anymore. He realized that for most Jews, I could make arguments about why the Torah Sheva'al Peh is authentic. But that's actually not what people need to hear. When you look at his 19 letters and his Choref, which are his two earliest writings, for example, let's just start with the Choref for a moment. some of you may be familiar with it. It is a presentation of Taryag Mitzvot, of 613 Mitzvot. Well, okay, we already have this from the Rambam and from many earlier writers. What he's doing, though, is not just giving you a list of the 613 Mitzvot. He's explaining them. He's not only explaining them, he's explaining them in ways that would be meaningful to an audience of the 1830s. He explains their symbolic value. Now, there are many things, you know this I think as well as I do, many mitzvot that are not so easy to explain, and whose relevance is not easy to explain in, you know, the 1830s. Well, this is exactly what Hirsch does. He doesn't bother with the issue of Torah Shebaal Peh and what its basis is. He just simply says, look, what is it that Jews today need? What Jews today need is some kind of a message and an insight into what the Torah offers that somehow is meaningful to them in their lives. And he's absolutely right about this. And in a certain sense, what you really are finding when you look at this young Hirsch, and he clearly continued to build on this as he matured and developed, it's just an appreciation for, let me try to find a fresh message, you know, for this generation. His 19 letters, frankly, is exactly that. Again, I talked about it a little bit at my earlier session. Just allow me to go back and briefly recount. The 19 letters is fictitious, but it purports to be the correspondence between two friends who meet after some years of separation. When they meet again, they realize they may have grown up, I think, in similar families, but one of them has clearly abandoned their left tradition. That is Benjamin and Naftali, and they see each other, and they have a very brief conversation on some railroad platform, and then both of them agree, we have to stay in touch and let us write. So what we have, effectively, is Benjamin's letter to Naftali. Naftali is Hirsch, saying, it was so nice to see you, but I really don't understand how someone like you could still remain traditional. And he sort of goes on about, you know, living in a modern new age, and, you know, in the age of enlightenment is the age where we could breathe and spread our wings, but you live within this confined tradition. And of course, then the other 18 letters are Hirsch responding about why the tradition is not so confined, et cetera, et cetera. Just think about this for a moment. Think about the literary context here. It's letters that are accessible to everybody. And this is why it created a buzz. You suddenly had somebody for the first time standing up and trying to explain and give a feel for you know, the beauty of the Torah and the meaning of traditional Judaism, not just in the old terms of this is what we must believe and there is a Torah Shebaal Peh and this is what, but rather in some completely other new and creative fashion. And that was, in fact, I think, Hirsch's greatness. It was precisely not that, again, fully aware of what the Haskalah did, and fully aware, actually, that the Haskalah was a perfectly traditional response, but that we needed a new traditional response. And we needed in terms that were responsive to the here or now. Something that would speak to the Jewish youth now, 1830s. Okay, so that, I mean, it's a quarter to two. That was effectively what I wanted to touch on. Obviously, I'm happy to open this up and to debate. Again, just going back to where I began, this is, as a historian, this is why I think historical context is useful. And I think in this case, we sometimes miss what was new about Hirsch and what was effective about him. And again, he really was. You know, there's a lot where I think Hirsch is dated, I'll be honest, and I'll perhaps say this at the panel discussion as well. Precisely, it's a double-edged sword. I just finished saying that I think Hirsch realized that you need a message for the 1830s that was fitting for the 1830s and the 1840s and 1850s. That is a double-edged sword. He realized he needs something fresh and new, which he delivered. At the same time, frankly, his response is a response of the 1830s, 40s, and 50s. We are now, last time I looked, in 2009, meaning that the world has moved on. And in some ways, I think there's a distance between us and Hirsch. And I think I have to be honest about that. I do find that certainly when I read him. But nevertheless, I think, you know, the challenge of a historian and the challenge of thinking historically is to put everybody into their own context and realize what that context meant and realize what issues were they dealing with and what were they deeming to be ineffective and what have they chosen now, you know, as a new and effective measure. Okay, with that I conclude, And if there are questions or comments, we can.
And the confessional system that Dr. Haberberg described, did that exacerbate the tensions that, like what you're describing, are honest intellectual differences, but it seems to become very personal in that world, like with the Frankfurter main congregation hiring an Orthodox rabbi alongside of Hirsch.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're mixing different issues here. I would say, though, very simply, I mean, look, you're right, there is the ideological level and there is the personal level. Again, I mentioned in my last talk, Hirsch was somebody who knew Abraham Geiger. They had been friends at some point. He knew, had, you know, grit. There's many people with whom he ended up going to battle with. And then one of them happened to be the new Orthodox Rav much later in Frankfurt. You know as well as I do, we're human beings. And yes, we have our ideological differences, and you know fully well that that's sometimes exacerbated or perhaps attenuated by the personal relationships. It does get personal, in other words, because people can't always separate the personal from the from the ideological.
And what I'm asking is, like in North America, it's a consensual relationship. So while there are tensions, we don't have to associate with anybody we don't want to associate with. But there in Frankfurt, they're all gotten together.
Absolutely. Look, let me also say that when in this talk, I ended up talking about Hirsch only up to the 1830s, mainly. He wasn't in Frankfurt at the time. What you're really getting at, and you're right, is that in the European context, people were locked into a community in a way that we're not. Right? That's exactly it. So they had to deal with each other because there is only one official community. And as a Jew, you have to belong. And then the question becomes, so how do we get along? How do we get along, particularly because you now have a different axe to grind and you have a different ideological perspective? We have a very different reality, and you're right about that. That's both a blessing and a curse. I think it's a curse in some ways because we can ignore each other. You can also say it's a blessing. It depends. I have to say, of course, the Israeli context is very different again. We are again in Israel locked in, although it's not a small community like Frankfurt, but let's be honest here. There is one Rabbanut in Israel. And by law, we are, whether we like it or not, locked into a certain relationship. Now, when that Rabbanut is deemed as failing or being, and I think you know some of the issues, whether it's the issue of Shemitah or the issue of conversions, it becomes a real issue. See, we're back to that issue again of we all officially have to deal with a Rabbanut. What do you do when you don't agree with that Rabbanut? What alternatives are there? And then the tensions build because you need some kind of an out or some kind of a release or... That's actually what's happening right now in Israel. Again, I wouldn't say it's at a crisis point or a breaking point, but I have to see how things shake out. But I appreciate your question. You're right. Germany was a very different reality where people were locked into having to have, a certain kind of relationship with each other by the mere fact that they were all officially members of the same Jewish community. And how to deal with that? That's the, million-dollar question. Then and now.
You said at the beginning that the beginning of Orthodoxy really could be dated somehow as a reaction to the Reform. I think this is more than the question of semantics. What do you call Jews who are alive, who were Shomer Shabbat, let's say, before Orthodoxy?
Oh, perfect. I love that. That's exactly the issue. You see, you're very nice. Exactly. Orthodoxy emerges at a certain point in history. It's when people take on the label of, oh, we are Orthodox, meaning I'm different than you. My club is different than your club. My shul is different than your shul, etc. You're right. That, in fact, as a real label, it's really only in this era, the 1830s, 40s, 50s, when it emerges. You know that really it was used as a slur. It was used by Reform to criticize the small O Orthodox. Orthodox just means those who have like the right opinion. Orthodox really just connotes I'm right and this is what I believe and I'm not going to budge. It was a label thrown at a certain crowd who then said, you know what? We are Orthodox. Who turned it around and used it so that's really what happens. You're right. There is no label. I mean, these are simply good traditional Jews who are just trying to grapple with these realities. But I love your question because you're right. It wasn't that suddenly someone woke up and said, They have gone on along. What it is almost like an ideological reconfiguration. It's saying, you know, let's reorganize and rethink who we are. And that's exactly what Orthodoxy does. It becomes a label. But again, it becomes a label and then also something of an impediment, if you will, something of a wall. Meaning, you know, we're different, they're different.
We're better.
Well, okay. Yeah, you're right. Again, it's funny. You're going in directions that, of course, I didn't go in this talk. It may actually be best, to be honest with you, to ask that if you're going to stick around for the panel. Because my colleagues there have spoken about this. And we can all speak to this. But you're right. I want to say, that, like in everything else, you know, these aren't simple figures, these aren't simple thinkers, and these aren't simple times. And you're absolutely right. There's definitely some ironies and paradoxes and contradictions, or maybe they're not really contradictions, but... you're right. You're exactly right. I think, but one is let's just remember, one is an issue of how to structure the community vis-a-vis other Jews who may be different than us, and the other one is, okay, once I've worked out an issue of structure, what do I culturally believe? You know, is it good for my kids to study German or English or French or...
Did you coin it? I can't remember. Somebody socially Haredi and intellectually...
That wasn't me. Right. Yeah, yeah. No, one of these other fellows. It's a very good, fair question. But you're right. There's a lot of complexity here. A lot of complexity here. Absolutely. Again, I think someone mentioned, and it's true, Hirsch showed up in synagogue basically looking like a Protestant minister. He wore a long black gown with a little white bow tie of a certain, I don't know, there's a word for it, I just don't know. Absolutely, and that was fully... Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Because he felt, look, this is how clergy look. This is how clergy look. This is how, you know... Men and not women in those days, but men of the cloth look. Whether you're Protestant or Reform or Orthodox, this is how you look. So why shouldn't he would say, it's a certain way in which in society we say, you are our spiritual leader. I'm the spiritual leader, that's how I'm going to look.
It doesn't make sense. I don't understand. They don't like the outside.
Very good, right. Okay, you're absolutely right. But don't forget, it's not, in the case of Hirsch, it's not that everything outside is pasul and treif. That's exactly how he's different. He's saying, why don't we consider what it is that we can do to make traditional Judaism more palatable? And he says that this is window dressing. Now, it happens to be very important to him, but window dressing is just that. Why can't we not, you know, dress like German clergy, and read Goethe and recite Racine and etc. This meant a great deal to him. The truth is, I have to tell you, I think for Hirsch, appearances really did mean a great deal. It was very important for him to show that traditional Judaism did not look backward, and also read into that word Eastern European, which for a Yeki was... I'm being very serious here. I'm being very serious here. Appearances did matter a great deal, as they do. I mean, maybe we don't feel that way. I can't say I'm one who feels so strongly that way, but they really do matter. The way in which you present yourself, think about it. I mean, Rabbanim have a certain way of dressing. Why? I don't see why. But again, I appreciate that you're struggling with it, and that's absolutely fair, and that's welcome, and that's very important. But I could see sort of where these issues fit together. Again, what Hirsch ultimately, of course, does, he is the one who embraces. He he embraces culture. He had a piano at home. He wants to take his kids to concerts. He wants them to be aware. He wants them to sort of breathe in the best of what Germany has to offer. Now, this is the trick, of course. He called it true culture. As far as he's concerned, true culture is the best of non-Jewish society, which is true culture. That we have to expose our kids to. Now, the trick here is that in that culture is also not true culture, meaning things that are distorted or unhealthy or, And so that's what he would say. He would say, part of what we need to do is filter out. But filter means you let certain things in and you keep certain things out. I don't think that should be such a foreign concept, I think, to us. Okay, well, I think then we've wound down. I'll certainly stick around for a few moments, and then I guess we will make our way. No, I'm sorry. Okay. Thank you.
We hope you found this recording a most enjoyable learning experience. We welcome your feedback. Please contact us at info@TorahInMotion.org or at www.TorahInMotion.org. Have a great day. Thank you.